Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Phil Harvey and Lisa Conyers. They're the author of the new book, The Human Cost of Welfare, How the System Hurts the People It's Supposed to Help. Phil is chairman of DKT International, a group that provides family planning and HIV/AIDS prevention programs around the world. And he's also chairman of Adam and Eve, the mail order catalog that sells sexually oriented books and films. He's the author of several previous books, including The Government Versus Erotica, which detailed his legal battle with federal and state prosecutors over selling sexual explicit materials, and Showtime, a novel about a reality TV show gone wild. I should mention also, too, that Phil is a patron of many libertarian organizations, including Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes Reason TV. His co-author, Lisa Conyers, is a writer and analyst at the DKT Liberty Project, which circulates reports, studies, and op-eds on topics such as welfare policy, free speech, and income inequality. Lisa and Phil, welcome.
Thank you.
Your book is about welfare and how it traps people into a system. First, give a sense of the range and the breadth of what of the types of programs that we call welfare. What are some of them, and overall, what's a ballpark estimate of how much money we're spending on welfare programs?
The ballpark number on welfare expenditures is $700 billion a year at the federal level. And when you add in state expenditures on welfare, and we're talking here just about means-tested welfare programs, not entitlements like Social Security. So that $700 billion, one of the depressing things is to compare that to the defense budget, but that's only $600 billion.
Right.
So welfare now exceeds defense spending, and
so it's one of the single largest items then in the federal budget.
Indeed, it is, and one of the reasons the federal budget, of course, is getting squeezed on other discretionary kinds of things.
So when we talk about welfare, what are the there's things like food stamps. What are the other types of major programs that go into what we call welfare?
I mean, a lot of people think of welfare as just cash assistance, and they think of families getting a check in the mail. But for example, food stamps alone has 45 million people. There's public housing assistance. There's Medicaid. There's the Obama phone, which is actually a phone system that is provided to poor people, but it's been around since Reagan or before. So it's not really the Obama phone, it's just that people have heard about it
and
more
it's,
now.
And it's a welfare program that helps people who otherwise wouldn't have access to a phone,
right.
Now to a cell phone.
And the idea being that they could use it to apply for jobs or,
right.
to stay in contact with friends and family.
Talk a little bit about the interviews that you did. I mean, there are people all over the country you talked to. How did you find them? How did you locate them? But then also, how did you find them?
Well, I traveled all over the country for this book. I went from Hawaii to California, Washington State, Oregon, Georgia, South Dakota, and basically, I wanted to know how it felt to actually be on welfare. You can read about what the rules are, how you think it works, but then you go out and actually talk to people about how it plays out in their real life. And so I would drive into a town and park at either a soup kitchen or a public park or bus stops. And just look for people who look like they'd be willing to talk and sit down and ask them about their town or, tell me about this neighborhood. I'm new here, I'm visiting, and I'm here writing a book, and it's about welfare. Would you be willing to talk to me? And I was really amazed at how open people were to sharing their stories and telling me about, what it was like to be on food stamps, how their Medicaid card worked, what they did with their cash assistance.
The two things that struck me was, first off, is how incredibly complex all of these systems seem to be. There are people who go out and recruit people to be on welfare and whatnot, but the systems themselves seem very complicated. And then how both kind of ingenious, and I don't even mean that in a negative way, but how kind of smart the people are, like they totally know the systems. Mm-hmm. And if you could talk a little bit, maybe in a general way, of they know when, if they hit a certain threshold, they're going to lose more benefits than they would gain from having a job or something. Mm-hmm. Like, talk a little bit about the mindset that they use to calculate their total benefits package.
Well, they do. They would. I mean, I called it doing the math, because they really would. They knew exactly down to the penny how much they would get based on, which programs they were in and how much income they had coming in. And it was actually frightening for them sometimes to think about, oh, taking that extra hour of work or, you know, taking that raise, because then they would lose their benefits, because they knew, you know, if I go over this line by even a dollar, I could lose my food stamp benefit, I could lose my housing benefit. And when you're not, when you're at those low level jobs that might come and go, it can be kind of scary to take on the extra income, because then you're losing quite a big benefit that's pretty dependable. So most of the people I met knew exactly how much they could make, and they knew how much they were getting every month, and they relied on it. And it's small sums of money, but it's really important when it's what you're living on.
What would you say is, how often do people, or is there a set percentage you could say that people on welfare or on some type of assistance go into a gray market? So they're working, mm-hmm. you know, above board and whatnot, but then because they know that next dollar is going to kill me on my benefits, and mm-hmm. then they start doing stuff off the books.
Oh, yeah. I think off the books work is very, very common. I don't think I met anybody that wasn't doing some kind of off the books work. And people trade and barter a lot. I mean, they trade babysitting for car maintenance, for a place to sleep, for or they'll sell their food stamps, you know, in order to get some cash to go pay for something. Right. So there's a very, very active underground economy.
The off the books part, I find rather encouraging, because people want to work, right, and they want to earn money. They just don't want to lose their benefits. And I think one of the worst things about the welfare system is that it induces this psychology of fear of earning too much. Mm-hmm. The prospect of having all your benefits cut off, or some, or a significant part of your benefits cut off, makes people look on earning income as risky.
How did that come to be a defining kind of characteristic of the system? Because the whole idea of work of welfare reform in the 90s was that it was supposed to be workfare, it was going to be time limited, it was going to push people to work, which is what mm-hmm. everybody wants. Nobody wants to be dependent. And yet now you're saying that, you know, people don't want to work, or they realize that work is risky. That obviously means that something is terribly wrong in the system.
Well, the reforms of 1996, which were real and to a considerable extent effective, were in the aid to families with dependent children, which was transformed into a program, as you suggest, that was time limited, that required work, that offered some training and job placement. But what has happened is that that program is now about 2 or 3% of the total welfare package. It's still there. It still has work requirements, but food stamps are much, much bigger. No work requirements there. The combination of these programs for people who are eligible for them provide sufficient income to get by, but induce a sense of entrapment because of the fear of having them cut off if they earn too much money, or if the caseworker finds out that they are, horror of horrors, actually earning more money than they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about housing assistance. You guys write that, and I'm quoting here, subsidized housing is a major component of the U.S. federal welfare system, with the cost of the program doubling between 1990 and 2010, even though the number of recipients has stayed about the same. How does housing assistance hurt the poor?
Well, probably the biggest problem with housing assistance is that people are in public housing that no longer qualify for it. And the reason for that is because the way the system was designed was with the idea that we want people to have a stable place to live, and then they can work on finding jobs and working their way out of poverty. And so we didn't have the kind of checking in and making sure that you're still on benefits that we have with other programs. So for example, in my travels, I met people often who said that they had no hope of getting into the public housing in the towns or cities that they lived in because they were completely full, and in many cases full with people who no longer actually qualified for the program, but there was nobody telling them to move out.
So there was no follow-up to say,
right,
okay, you're now making it, and so now you should find your own place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I met one young gal in the Bronx, and she told me a story of her aunt who had been in the same public housing unit for 30 years mm-hmm. and had moved in and out of it, rented it out to other people, had long since stopped being in poverty, but no one had ever checked on her. And meanwhile, this young gal had two kids and really needed the program and was told that she was on a waiting list that was 10 years long.
Some original abuses there. I mean, if you qualify for housing, then live in it for a couple of years, then you don't qualify anymore. and you rent it out to your relatives or to somebody else, and you can work your way out of poverty just as a landlord renting out a piece of housing that you're not supposed to have. Mm-hmm. That happens.
And again, you're right, that's pretty inventive. I mean, it's a sign of somebody, you know, if they were applying that ingenuity to the actual economy, it'd be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Medicaid is health care for the poor, and it's paid for jointly by the states and the federal government. It's a massive expense. In most states, Medicaid is always either the first or second biggest thing that they spend money on. And now, if you make a certain salary, you don't qualify for Medicaid and a host of other programs. And then you quoted in a book a woman named Annie, a mother of two in Oregon, who said, "I'm not going to find a job that pays enough to make up for the value of my Medicaid coverage for me and my two kids." And this refrain comes up again and again. Recipients realize that they're going to lose a lot more than a little bit they would gain from money. Is that a ubiquitous problem in these means-tested programs? And then how do you deal with that? Because you need to have a cutoff, right, for people where, okay, you're not getting assistance anymore. But how do you change that kind of plateau where people just drop off the face of the earth if they make a little bit more?
Well, to begin with, you have to deal with the culture of the system. The culture of the system is geared to maintaining itself. The people who work in the welfare business, their jobs depend on it. They have very little incentive to get people out of welfare and into jobs. They lose some of their potential income as a result of that. One of the most telling stories that came out of this process is a man of about, I don't know, 30, 35, named Angel, who related his visits to his welfare office. He says, "You go in, there's nothing about jobs." He said, "You go in on the bulletin board. Need food stamps? Need help with Medicaid?" He said, "Everything is geared in the whole system to more welfare, different welfare. They should put up a sign," he said. "He said, 12 jobs available this week in this community." He said, "It never happens." Yeah. So the culture of the system is anti-job, pro more welfare, and the only way to change that, it seems to me, I mean, part of the way is to make work pay, as in EITC, which we do need to address. But part of it is to make work, looking for work, training for work, the part of every one of these programs.
You call the earned income tax credit welfare done almost right. Describe it for us and then explain, you know, why it's not quite done right.
Well, the idea is to make work pay by topping up the wages of very low-income people, and we think that makes sense. It is a fairly complicated way to approach it because it is done through the income tax system, originally designed to repay income tax withheld from low-income people. Now, if you're working and your income is low enough, you're going to get, in effect, your wages topped up. This is, I think, the right approach. We think it would work much, much better if instead of having to file an income tax return in March or April every year, these funds were simply made available every pay period so that people would be taking home a bigger check rather than going through the rather complicated IRS system, sometimes with the help of agencies that are not entirely ethical in all cases.
The EITC basically only available either to married couples or people with
people
children.
With children. I mean, this is the other really big flaw, and both conservatives and liberals, most recently President Obama himself, have said this is a big mistake. We ought to make EITC available much more generously for the childless.
Phil, as a good libertarian, you don't like social engineering through the tax code. For sure. So, yeah, why should people with kids get extra money? But why should, if you're an able-bodied single person, why should you be getting any kind of welfare, whether it's done through the tax code or not?
The whole concept of welfare to libertarians is troublesome, of course. It's troublesome in that you are patronizing people by taking money from some people and giving it to others, for starters. And it is certainly a patronizing when we say, you can't have this money unless you do A, B, and C, which is what I'm suggesting, right. And I do so with attached reluctance. It's a little like a parent saying to a child, yeah, you can get your $25 allowance, but only if you pick up your room. That kind of patronizing behavior to us libertarians is repugnant. But in the situation that we have now, it is better to put conditions on welfare payments than to simply go on dishing them out and perpetuating poverty in the ways that we have described.
Yeah, we live in a world now where we expect our work, or most of us expect our work, to be expressive of our values and of our lifestyle and what we care about or who we are. Is that, you know, how do you bring that down to a lower level of, you know, service economy or jobs that generally are not particularly, you know, that glamorous, it seems?
Well, I think that any job is better than no job, and most of the people that I interviewed said they'd rather be working. They didn't want to be on welfare. That was not how they envisioned their life would be. I heard that phrase over and over again, that I thought I was going to be part of the American dream. I was going to have a house, I was going to have a car and two little kids and go to work every day, and now I'm just surviving. I'm just getting by on these checks that come in the mail. And all of them said, you know, I would rather be the one buying stuff for my kids. I would rather be the one paying the rent. You know, I don't want to be in this situation. There's no hope here. And so I think that the argument that it has to be a glamorous job of some kind isn't necessarily accurate. I think that most people, I mean, remember your first jobs, my first jobs, Phil's first jobs, probably weren't the most exciting jobs in the world, but they were, I look back on them as incredibly rewarding. That first check, no matter what you did to get it, was more rewarding than getting something in the mail. And so I think that's part of it. And the other part is, the more people we can get to work, then they start working on their own careers. And that's where that pleasure of working hard at something and working your way up comes about. But it doesn't come about by sitting at home and just taking benefits and not working.
People have an innate desire to accomplish things. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to be able to say, I did that. I fed my kids. I put shoes on the baby. I brought home a paycheck. There are different ways of accomplishing that in life, but for most people, earning money at a job is an important component of it. When you take that away, you take away dignity, you take away a sense of self-worth. When you're accepting money from some source that you know you can never repay, that's bad for people. They don't like it. You have an unrepayable debt. So that when we talk about the issue of happiness in the early part of the book and the importance of work to just fundamental human happiness, Lisa's absolutely right. It doesn't matter if it's a lousy job. Any job is better than no job.
All right, well, we will leave it there. I want to thank Phil Harvey and Lisa Conyers for talking to Reason TV. They are the authors of the new book, The Human Cost of Welfare, How the System Hurts the People It's Supposed to Help. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.